Studio. Said join. No camera.
You are joining the online studio. You are unmuted and can speak with the host.
I hope so. I am the host. Okay, he's dialed and they changed the interface a little bit. Dr. Pepper slash 7 Up. Caffeine contents 58 milligrams. Not sure how much that is compared to the rest. Okay. Hey Barry, you there?
Hey, yeah, I'm here. I'm here.
Okay. They changed the UI a little bit on the interface. So instead of having directly in the middle, now you're just considered one of the participants. So
Oh no.
no, that's fine. It just makes accessing and muting you and that kind of thing a little more of a challenge overall. Either I can watch the chat or I can look at the participants. I can't do both.
In the middle of a gout flare-up, which happened after I got home tonight. This is
Oh,
the
fun.
last time I talked to you. Yeah, I mean, was it yesterday when I got to Atlanta Airport? I walked. I didn't use the tram. I went from through security, and I went through. I don't know if you've ever been through Atlanta Airport.
I went through it one time and it's been a long time ago, like 25 years
They have
ago.
a it's they have five or six terminals, and between each terminal of and remember that they have planes, large planes, 747s parked on either side of the terminals, so they have to space them quite a ways away from each other because you need room for the planes to get in and all that. So it's probably a good quarter mile between each terminal. And so you start at actually before the A terminal. And I went all the way to the D terminal. Now I have a train that runs, but I said, nah, I'm just going to walk it. And I raced through that whole section. And of course, it's underground, so they have escalators. It's way underground. So walked up the escalators, the whole nine yards. Man, I was moving. That was yesterday. Today, I can barely walk to the bathroom.
Dang. Dang. Yeah, for me, my last time I was in that airport, I was taking that was just another flight from Atlanta, and I was taking basically a puddle jumper to Hilton's Head because there was a conference. HP was holding their annual conference in Hilton Head. It's like, okay, for like drivers and printer drivers and so forth. This is back in the day when HP actually didn't create. It's before they created their own drivers. Actually, then they st just started to because it's. Let me see, Windows had just, was Windows out yet? I forget. But the bad old days of DOS, where you had to do all
Okay.
the drivers and write your program so it actually would communicate, send the proper codes and so forth to the HP printers. Actually, that was kind of interesting, because even back in that day, which is so many years ago, they were talking about true color.
Now, was that
color.
Using parallel port?
Yeah, you use parallel ports.
How were you talking to?
Parallel ports and sometimes serial cables, depending upon which one you're talking to. That's when
Centronics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Centronics port, or was it a DB25?
I don't remember. I think it was DB25. Yeah, it was DB25. Yes, that's what it was.
Oh God, it's scary that I know these things.
It's scary that I remember these things.
Now, when you were riding the driver, you were actually talking to the driver chips.
The driver. I was actually sending it over the port to the printer. Mm-hmm. So you had to make sure that you had. Usually, it was. Bitmaps, basically, it was bits. Mm-hmm. Which one? Now, depending upon which printer, color was done multiple different ways. Some of them mm-hmm. had it so that each pixel was a separate byte, and that defined the color. Some of them mm-hmm. had it so you had to send three lines. One was the red, one was the green, and one was the blue. For that one line.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It was interesting.
Send the whole line, and you'd send a whole nother line, and you'd send a whole nother line.
Yep, yep.
And the color information. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was doing that back in the day.
And the printer would queue all that up and then print the whole line at once.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone went
mostly PostScript.
Yeah, now when you say color, you're talking inkjet?
Yep.
Or was this...
Don't get me started on those. We had the inkjet printers from HP. We had... This was the weirdest thing ever created, which was this one printer we had was actually wax transfer.
I remember wax transfer. Yep. Daisy wheel?
No, actually, these were sheets of colors, and what you for
oh,
each
okay.
page
yeah.
you have a you know you have like CMYK
thermal.
Thermal for each
yeah.
one. It would depending upon mm-hmm. what color it was, it would actually imprint the amount of proper dots for the proper color.
And you'd have a ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
With the color.
It was these. Plastic sheets of this one.
Okay.
So each page had a separate color, and this was what's considered a laser printer. You know. That was a weird printer, but hey, it worked. If you needed color printing early in the day, that's the way to do it.
Expensive as heck.
Sure. And then of course that was also back in the days where plotters were plotters. They pick up an actual
pen plotters.
Pen, an actual pen and draw on the paper.
Yep, and you can get different fineness of pens.
Yeah, that
different
was
plotters had cartridges with multiple pens, because if you had to change colors, yeah.
Yeah, let me think.
Yeah.
The Brüning Zeta, okay, of course you had the HP. You had we had one. We got one plotter. It was huge. It was so wide. We didn't figure it. It took us a while to figure out. But it had to be in a climate-controlled environment for the electrostatic plotter to work. We kept on failing. We're going, what the hell? Why is it failing? Then we finally figured it out. Got a dehumidifier for the room to bring down the humidity. And then it worked. I forgot how we figured that out. My guess is we called the company going, why is this failing? And they go, isn't this a climate controlled environment? No. Why not? If it's a requirement for these printers. It's like, well, whatever. Okay, let me get the thing started.
Mm-hmm.
Stop talking about the old days.
That wasn't that long ago.
We had to rent our own freaking drivers. We had to create our own UI. We did. I was supporting an actual graphical user interface. I
remember talking directly to the UART chips on a PC, and also the PIC module, the PIC chip for interrupt controller.
Uh-huh. Oh,
programmable
geez.
Interrupt controller.
Oh, geez. Interrupts. Yeah. Okay. Before I go down that rabbit hole, and we'll be spending the next hour doing nothing when it comes podcast wise. So hold on. Okay, give me this. Okay, and give me that. Okay, we'll start this way. Oh, I'm not sure what we're gonna do about the. I think we'll leave it like this at the moment. But anyway. Okay. Excuse me. Okay, we're good. And it's me, it's the one, the only Paul Friends, welcoming you to Star of the Universe On Call. And tonight, you got me, you got Barry, you got no one else at the moment. There'll probably be some people who'll be happy to show up on the Twitch channel. So just a reminder for those who watch this on YouTube that we do have a channel on Twitch, SFU On Call, so that if you want to, you can join the chat room while we broadcast this. It starts somewhere between 9:30 and 9:40. Depends upon if I get sucked into some conversation about the old days when I first started working. I mean, these were the days. This was, you know, when we did DOS. We actually had we were pretty low level at that point. You know, operating systems weren't these multitasking operating systems. Well, they did have those, but those are all these big, huge servers somewhere. But anyway, not to go down that rabbit hole again, but I don't think you care about that unless you're like me. Remember those days. And with that, Barry, how you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. And they didn't call them servers. They called them mainframes back then.
Yeah, that's true. Some of them were mainframes.
Truly coded. Haven't truly coded unless you're doing coding where one of your debugging tools is a soldering iron.
Wow, yeah. I still remember working those days.
That's when I actually soldered wires to the computer board, hooked up a digital scope to it, and was testing the program by looking at traces on the scope. I got to the point where I could read RS-232 characters and DF-1 protocol from a scope trace.
Well, my friend, this is where you went down a lower path than me when it comes to the level of programming. You're dealing directly with like controllers and so forth. I was going a little higher, a little bit above the operating system. So that's where our experience is different, because I still remember having we had a couple of Microvaxes in the office. At one point, we actually had one of those graphical workstations. You know, the high-end graphical workstations we had in, because somebody wanted us to port it to. We had it on the Microvax, and we had it so they actually could do all the graphical stuff on the graphical workstation. It was kind of cool. Also, that was the weirdest thing, which was the VMS file system on those Microvaxes, where each file had a version number associated with it. So every time you modify the file, it created a new version. The problem with that was, of course, that invariably we had a very small hard drive. So invariably had to delete the old versions to get comfortable with doing that. So anyway, stop that now.
Okay. One last story. One last story. was in college, I had a homework assignment for astronomy class. And one of the things we were supposed to do was create a chart for star magnitude versus absolute magnitude versus intensity,
mm-hmm.
and color, I think it was.
Right.
And so I said, I'm going to combine that. So I went to the computer department, and I actually learned how to program a pen plotter, and I literally had to write the code to drive the pen plotter,
mm-hmm.
and I found a font in Gothic English characters to do the legends on the X and the Y axes of my chart.
A font, so you actually had to draw the letters?
Yeah, it was a pen plotter that was drawing the letters, and I found a font for Gothic English characters.
Yeah, but I mean, you actually had to draw the letters versus some. When I got into development, you could actually say, okay, here's text, and the plotter had a certain character set, you know, certain font that it would actually draw out the characters.
Yeah, I did. That's what I did.
Okay,
but it was also a matter of. I had to write code to draw the lines of the mm-hmm. graph and say, okay, this is the XY coordinates for this text, and I want these characters in this font, and this is the location for that text. So mm-hmm. I had to set all that up and put up a legend. Yeah. Definitely got an A on that homework assignment. I think that was one where the professor actually framed that homework assignment and said, okay, nobody else is ever going to top this one. Yeah, because most people were just drawing it in by hand and turning it in. Which is all he expected is like, holy crap. You spent some time on that one.
Yeah, but I had fun. Oh, yeah.
I
still remember some homework assignments from back in college. That they had, somebody did a really good job on our compiler class where the teacher actually got involved helping debugging the compiler, you know, with the student.
Wow.
Well, because he loved that was his thing, compiler and data structures and that kind
his
of
writing.
Thing.
So. Yeah, writing. I actually took structure classes in data structures. And then people are like, why are you taking that? You're a physics major, not a comp sci. I'm like, no, I don't know.
Yeah, well I was a comp sci major.
Yeah.
I
also took numerical computing, which was the killer course for the comp sci. I just took it as an elective, and then people are like, why are you doing that? It's an easy A.
Yeah.
And they're like, But then I when I took thermo, everybody's like, oh, my God, it's thermo. And it's like, easy A.
Yeah, back in the day, we could be talking about back, you know, play the old man card. Back in my day, when you really had to develop, you know, you actually had to use the soldering iron. You had to
wanted to get there, you had
the
to
switches.
Saddle up the horse, and
you couldn't.
Oh,
you
I just, remember.
Yes, turn on the computer and it started.
On,
you actually had to write your own bootloader.
PDP 11 with paper tape, and the operating system came on paper tape. And
I was a little farther along on that one. We actually had floppy drives. We have 8-inch floppy drives. To put up our PDP
11s. I remember 8-inch floppies.
Yeah. They had one, two of them. One was a system disk, and the other one was the quote-unquote user disk, the one where we actually save our programs. And actually, don't get me started on that one, man. Just because of PDP 11, we took our assembly language course on the PDP 11. And the PDP 11 assembly language was mm-hmm. a beautiful, beautiful assembly language. Just because of it was mm-hmm. almost feature complete, in that you had all the different modes for accessing the registers and the memory and all that. For all you could do, almost everything from every
modes,
operation.
Yeah, indirect and.
Yep, indirect,
index,
and direct, and
indirect,
all that. All that. Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's like,
and then
oh.
there was IBM 360 assembler using EBCDIC instead of
oh,
ASCII.
Geez, that, oh, don't get me started. Oh, that I'm glad I never ever
and
experienced
and punch cards. We did it in punch cards.
Oh, I still remember when the year I started at Drexel in 1984. Going into the Corman mm-hmm. Center, which was a computer center at Drexel University, and that is that at that time, I still remember seeing in this one room just piled up to the side all of these punch card machines.
Yep.
You know, because they just introduced, okay, instead of doing punch cards, now we're doing everything on the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had the first Macs, the 128K. Little thin little Macs where you
with
had
the black
little
and
three
white,
and a half inch.
With the black and white, yeah.
No, it wasn't black and white. Yeah. Well, it was black and white screen, yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And it kind of was a portable computer if you think about it. Because you could.
It was.
You could
screen
carry it around.
The same machine.
You could carry it around, you just had to plug it in. You know? So it wasn't a laptop, but it was a luggable. It worked.
I even got a
bag for it so I could actually lug it around when it comes to. Going home for weekends, but also going home for like winter break, things like that.
Yeah.
But anyhow, stop that
now.
We
had one of those punch card machines in our high school.
Understood.
So we'd do our punch cards and we'd give them to the teacher and she'd take them down to the insurance company, and they'd run it through their IBM 370s, and we'd get our printouts back the next day, and we'd find all the bugs in our code.
Oh, yeah. Understood. Okay, well, that's it for that. Yeah. We need to get on the actual topic for this evening, because we already spent over 10 minutes, well, probably on 10 minutes, talking about the old days of development and computers. And I'm sure most people are going, why am I even listening to this? Because
there's Starfleet battles.
A lot of times it's engineers. Which actually brings up always an excellent question I have for, especially today, which is if you've actually looked at a lot of the games that are being played and being advertised and things like that. The question is, for games like Starfleet Battles, is there a big interest out for it? That is, tactical war games. I know strategically speaking, yeah. There's still games out there for turn-based strategy games, and they're still doing well. You know, it's a smaller core group. But when we're talking now, we're talking about stuff. We're going from strategy game where things like your
Endless
troop
space.
Movements are represented by a little counter that's moving along this road. That's like a squad moving down the road. You know, and have it on a nice map, and you have all the rules and so forth, which is all really nice. So you have certain kind of tactics and strategies to do that. But the question is, for things like what we have for, you know, like BattleTech, you know, BattleTech. I'm not sure that this game exists anymore. Which is back in the day, there was one called Silent Death.
Never heard of that one.
Have you? Or have?
I have not.
Wow. Many years ago when I went to Origins, that was the game to, that was one of the games to play. The big issue, the ways you want, Silent Death was one of those simplistic ways of doing movement, which I always didn't like versus Starfleet Battles. And that is, it used movement points. And what you did at the beginning of each turn, each player would roll for initiative and to see who moved first. And then you would use up all your movement points to position your ship. Now, if you were low on the totem pole and you move first, you might die that next turn.
Right, right.
Because you had no way of reacting to...
Higher initiative.
Right.
Yeah, higher initiative moves last.
Right, in which case they can get, they might be able to get right behind you, and you probably won't be dead, but you're not going to be in a good position. Versus Starfleet Battles, which was a proportional movement kind of system, which I think to this day is one of the things that makes Starfleet Battles and Federation Commander very unique overall compared to other tactical systems.
Well, in the sense that Starfleet Battles, you have the recharge time on your weapons is extraordinarily long, and therefore when you have your movement, you can, the ships can actually move quite a distance between firings of weapons, if you know what I'm saying.
Understood. Yeah, because,
and you have a lot of granularity there. It's not like, oh, I get to move five hexes and then make a firing decision.
Right.
That commander loses some of that Starfleet Battles granularity. Now, there's pluses and minuses to that. The plus, of course, is that a lot more fine control over things. But the downside is that it takes longer to play it.
Right. Well, agreed. What was I thinking of? Yeah, it makes it kind of less exciting, I guess, because you're constantly thinking about movement and moving along, you know. And it doesn't matter whether you're playing Starfleet Battles or Federation Commanders; same issue is involved, in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyhow, are people still interested in such a rich game as Starfleet Battles? That's my question. It's an honest question, you know.
Well, in that sense, I've seen a lot of games that have even more fiddle factors than Starfleet Battles, but those are all computer games where the computer might have hundreds of different factors.
Right. Agreed. When it comes to complexity, yeah. But I guess, and Lord knows there's still a lot of turn-based games out there, and they're still being produced. Turn-based games from Frozen Cortex is a excellent example. It's quite a few years old now, by now, but it's basically, it is a turn-based game. XCOM, another one. Turn-based.
Yeah.
The whole idea
Civilization.
Is, what?
Civ. Civilization. Yeah, you ever hear of Civilization? Sid Meier's Civilization?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a turn-based. And now there's another one, Endless Space. And that's turn-based also.
Right.
And I think they have Endless Legend, which is their version of Civ. Endless Space is basically Civ in space.
Yeah, but the...
Where you're colonizing star systems.
Mm-hmm. Oh, understood.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah. assuming I have time. Let's not go there at the moment. But anyway, the thing is, a lot of these other turn-based systems are turn-based in that you plot all of the actions that you're going to do for a turn, which I kind of like the whole idea of pre-plotting movement. Lord knows if you listen to this podcast long enough, you've heard me mention that on multiple occasions. And You know, so they plot it out versus Starfleet battles, where you, at least with the current system, the free movement system that is used, every single impulse, the whole turn itself takes 32 impulses. Or if you want to, you can go all the way down. The cadet version. Cadet version takes 8 impulses. But still, within each impulse, you have multiple actions you can take, and that's for one turn.
Yeah.
Versus a lot of the turn-based games are more of plan out a turn, execute the turn. You know, you plan out, he plans out, you know, sorry, your enemy, because that might be some, actually be a sheet.
Plot, move, fire is a turn.
Right, but
for example.
And the question is, when it comes to turn-based, in that case, you might plot, oh, okay, I'm going to move and then fire at this guy. Now, the question is, mm-hmm. will that guy still be in my firing arc when we both execute our movements?
Right.
You know? You don't know.
Or you could do plot, move, move, plot, fire, fire, next turn.
Right. Yeah, because if you think about Starfleet Marines. Let's talk about the state of Starfleet Battle Force now, wasn't it? Starfleet Marines. Where the whole idea of it's like F&E in that categorization, where in F&E you can move multiple hexes within a certain turn, but then within that same turn that you're moving, your opponent or opponents can then do reactionary movement based on what you did.
Hmm.
You know, whether that is engaging you or I'm not, I have to double check on Federation and Empire. Whether you have to, the only way you can do it is actually engage the enemy or you actually can fall back or whatever. But I know there is what's called reaction movement, which allows you. Your opponent or ends, to react to your movement on your turn.
Mm.
Which is a little different than the whole idea of plotting your turn out completely, including actions, and then execute. You know?
Right.
But anyhow. Moving on from that, I think most people will say there are people who want to play turn-based games, and definitely Starfleet Battles and Federation Commander are a very, in my mind, a very unique system. I've yet to find any other system that's quite like it when it comes to the whole idea of proportional movement. As you point out, Barry, the whole idea of you have a lot more movement decisions. You know, you move a lot faster than you can fire. So that makes it very unique in that aspect.
Well, with one caveat, you can fire that quickly. What you can't do is recycle your weapons that quickly.
Right, right. Well, that was what you were getting at.
Well, which is, you can move, fire. Now there's a long period of time before I can fire again.
Right, so you fire that same weapon again.
I have a lot of granularity as to when that firing opportunity happens, but once it happens, I'm not refiring that weapon for a long time.
Understood.
Some of those weapons can be 3 turns, 96 impulses. In some of the races, I think there may be even weapons that have longer charging times, but that's rare.
Yeah. There's usually a minimum recycle time of like 8 impulses, a quarter turn.
Minimum.
Okay. Anyhow, one of the purposes of this podcast this week was what I call the response to Gene's report. Gene Sexton, who works for ADB, created a report of basically response from the looks like it from most of his responses from the Facebook group, from the SFB fan page on Facebook. And there, this and also looks like there, we Steve Cole also posted this on the discussion board to find out, okay, what is it about SFB that you tried out SFB Online and you tried it, didn't like it, went away, and come back. And there are multiple things about that. Now, here's the one thing that actually got my interest. When I got an email directly from Russ from the chat room from the podcast. For those individuals who know Russ, he's a lot of times he hangs out here. Looks like he's not gonna be able to make it for this evening. I wish he could, but it is what it is. But anyhow, he replied to me personally on last week's podcast episode, and you can reply to me if you want to. You can send me emails or reply to the YouTube video, which I have a couple of people who do that, including with one character with a username of Patient Zero. Patient Zero, I think is it. I think I got that right. But anyhow, and reply to it, and if you want to email me, feel free at sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. So if you want to reply to me, feel free, because I'm more than happy to listen to what you have to say, and even we can have a strike up a conversation. And actually, that's what Russ did. Russ has done things in the past. He's shown me certain cool things that he's done in the past. One time he actually did a monsters scenario, and I think we discussed that a little bit, and some other things, including there was one Halloween episode that he helped out with. I forget what we did with that one. Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm doing good, Nick. Now, the one thing that he pointed out, and I think it was actually a great thing that he mentioned in the email, which is something that I did not hear from ADB. When they're talking about it, they talk about what do we need in SFB Online to grow the customers, get more customers. But that itself is too broad of a term, too broad of a, in my mind, it's a too broad a target. We're playing SFB, Starfleet Battles, Nick, just in case you didn't know. And that is, when it comes to growing SFB Online, the question comes to being who is our target audience at that point? If we say that we want new customers. Now, Russ pointed out that there was actually four. And I think mainly Steve Cole was talking to three of them, and the target audiences that that Russ describes were one, the current online subscribers. Are we trying to update the client to keep them? And as Russ pointed out in his email, that no. Most part, we're not trying to keep them because most of them know the interface by this point in time. They know how to use it. Yes, would they like to see improvements? Yes, they would like to see improvement. But at the same time, if you change the client too much, you're going to piss them off because of they don't know the client anymore. Now,
they've been using it for years.
Right, exactly. My guess is that if we make it easy enough to use to transition. And if I make the changes slowly over time to a certain degree, I might be able to keep them and still have one client. One thing that, Russ proposed was actually have basically two clients is what kind of what he pointed out, which is one that is the new hotness. And the other one's more of a legacy client. So people that know, you know, how things work, which would be interesting. But anyway, two SFBs who currently Starfleet Battles players who currently play as Starfleet Battles, but don't use the online client. Whether that means as Patient Zero was pointing out in the YouTube comment, which was sometimes what he does, is him and his friends, they use Zoom and, you know, to play over the internet. You know, so, so basically they do it old school with the actual board, counters, everything. You know, so it's as close as to, you know, an in-person experience as possible. And he said, you know, that's the way we do it. Well, I think that's a great thing you can do. But the question is, as I pointed out to him in the reply, which was that I know there's some people who actually can play, you know, in real person, you know, in real life. But they like using the client because of certain things. One of those things is that you can, you know, you have those things like, oh, the range utility, which tells you how far away your opponent is without having you actually have to count out the hexes. It's automatically done for you. When it comes to the energy allocation form, it automatically will do a calculate it, make sure that you don't overspend by, you know, by basically accidentally cheating kind of thing, completely accidentally.
Right.
You know, where you forgot how things get added up and you ended up wrong. And then there's the final one, which is quote unquote saving the game.
Which is kind of important.
Yeah, but in real life, saving the game requires you to do certain things. For example, either you need to basically hide the either you have to hide
the energy allocation,
the everything, the board and everything, or you have to write down every, you know, the positions and everything else, you know, including, you know, positions and facings and all that on a piece of paper so that you can reset the war back up. Because also then you have the whole problem with your cat who jumps up on the board and blows away your entire board, which you said, okay, we're going to get back to the board when we, you know, when you come back to my house, you know, next week or something along those lines, and that quote save game gets corrupted, you know, the whole cat situation. So,
our game got catted. Yes.
Yes. A big zinny just came in and wiped us out. So that's one thing I was pointing out to the person on YouTube. So because of that is one of those things that is quite interesting for people. You know, that's one of the reasons why they want to use an online client in some cases. You know, and that's why I point out that might be what they want. Now, get back to the responses, because Lord knows this might be a really long night if I don't get to the point. There are some things that were pointed out, and some of these things are a failure by me. I will agree. It's 100% a failure by me. Because of some of these things that they're pointing out, it's not obvious that you can do them. Now, I think some of it is the way the client interacts, and I think that might be why they say what they say. For example, One of them, this one person, Ginger, suggested adding a cadet missions from the cadet training manual. Have automated controls for the opposite side players, basically implement the robot player. And I'm halfway there already. If you use the SFB Online client, currently there is a cadet room. An SFB cadet room. So you actually can play the first six scenarios of the cadet training manual. Now, the one thing that is not there is the robot player. And actually, I did something, you know, to prepare for this evening. Give me a sec here. That is, I got this little beauty out, which is the cadet training manual. And actually, this is an old copy. This is how you know it's an old copy. You see Task Force Games in the back of it. And also, the beautiful part about this one is it still has the map. Because the Cadet Training Handbook had a map inside it. And I think it also had, and as part of the map on the edge, you had counters. It's a very, relatively light cardboard map. It's not a full map. It's, it's 28 by 20. No, sorry, 28 by 17 is what it is. So it's kind of a small map, but the whole idea is it's for training. What you would do is you'd buy this handbook and you'd have everything that you needed to learn Starfleet battles, at least to begin to learn how Starfleet battles operates, which actually is really cool. So, I've implemented, have it so that you can actually go into the cadet room and play. There is a bug where if you select one of the scenarios, you have to resize the window for it actually to show you the actual ships. I need to fix that. I spent quite a bit of time on that many years ago when I was first implementing the cadet room. And that, I never figured out why that occurred, because I know part of it, this is because of the redrawing and so forth, but I'm not sure what that is. Now, I think there's more to this part that is actually being asked for. And I want to get back to people discuss this more, because I think that the expectation is this. I think, and I like to go through the handbook again to see how much this would go. And that is basically a tutorial on how to play Starfleet battles. it would basically take your hand, a little bit. It'd be almost like learning how to use the client the same time you're learning how to play SFB. That's always part of the issue right there. But anyhow.
Right.
The hard part, the question is, would they want it to actually be a tutorial? Say, oh, no, you're doing that wrong. It's teaching about turn modes, because turn modes are not a scenario. Turn modes is one of the rules that's described in the training handbook. And that talks about, you have to move so many hexes forward. And then when your turn mode's fulfilled, then you can turn. And as part of a tutorial, if you want to actually have it so that you're teaching Starfleet battles, what you would do then is, have the person move the counter, however they want to do it using the client, whether it's clicking and dragging and moving it, or using the control panel, the control panel window, the game control window, and to move things or use the keyboard or however they want to do it. Now, obviously, when you first come into online client, you don't know all the different methodologies for moving your ships, moving your counters. But at the same time,
right? Yeah, there's a couple of ways of doing it.
Right, and you know, would that be the expectation for the client? And the question is, if you think about it, how much should the client be doing when it comes to helping people? Should it be a program which then helps you to learn Starfleet battles? Is that what the goal is? Because Steve Cole said new customers. Where?
Well, then you want to.
What's the audience? Which Russ was pointing out. You know, are we looking for potential new players to the game? Obviously, that would be a help. But the question is, how big of an audience is there for that? That's one thing we have no way of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can easily target the two others, which is the SFBs, the Starfleet Battles players that currently play, but they don't use the online client. Or number, and of course, the second one, which is ones people who used to play on the online client. Now, some of the people that I know that used to play the online client will not come back. And here's the reason why. Because they want the old SSDs. And they're actually, I forget where it is. Actually, yeah, I know I actually was part of the report. And that is one of the suggestions was a very interesting one, but it requires ADB's cooperation. Where is it? Here it is. Okay. Here was the suggestion. The suggestion was allow users to provide proof of what they own and make libraries personal to that user. Now, that way there isn't a downloadable library, but one tied to and tagged to that user. Begin tracking and integrate what people buy from the store. So then it becomes available for them to use on SFBOL. If they buy product XYZ, make the rulebook and SSDs available for them online. That, my dear friend, is something that ADB would have to agree to. I'm less worried about the rulebook portion. I'm more worried about the SSDs. Because ADB pull the original SSDs that are part of the SSD, you know, the module Rs, you know, and the actual rules, you know, actual part of the product. They pulled them that we had that were available on the client. I changed it so that you can no longer download them, and they wanted more.
I remember that.
You know, they wanted to have, so they were completely removed and were replaced by what we call the third gen definitions. And those third gen definitions are totally different the way they represent things, and outside of the online client, they are not usable. So,
right.
Yeah. So in that case, you know, that's one of the things that I can't do anything about. ADB would have to agree to something along those lines. And that's one thing I will probably, I'm not sure what I'm going to do about the report, i.e., but I'm going to actually reply to Steve Cole saying, okay, here's some of the things that I found in the report and that we have to, if you want to, we're going to have to discuss. And I'm sure one of the things, if I bring that up, he's going to say no.
Yeah. Okay.
Moving on. Some of the things, which I drives me crazy, in that here is what one of the comments. The interface needs to be reorganized and modernized. What does that mean? What does it mean to be modernized? As I'm the next, I pointed this out on the discussion board, and Steve Cole, replied to that and going, yeah, that because somebody had done the same thing to him. When they say, he needs the counters need to be updated, to be more modernized. And he's saying, and they told the person, what does that mean? Can you show me an example of what you're talking about?
You're supposed to know what that means. Why are you asking these questions?
Because
I was joking.
Yeah, I know you're being facetious. But that's the point, is what do you mean by modernize? I know Sean replied in discussion board showing all these, and he mentioned all these ones for Starfleet Command, some of the Star Treks, things like that. And the problem I had with every single one of them is that they're video games. They're not turn-based games. They're real-time strategy games. And real-time saying, this is what's modern? No. Try again. I need a modern... What's considered modern for a turn-based game? Go for it. I did do some of my own investigation, so I got an idea, and Lord knows Russ helped me in that regard. In that, let's see if I can have it here. Okay, here it is. And that is that the client is very black and white and largely text menu driven. I think this is why it is called as an outdated looking. It harkens back to the software of the mid 80s and the look. Trouble is how much to overcome that still be playing SFB instead of some watered down variant of the game. Doing colored menus such might be in more of early 90s feel, but I don't feel it's more than a band-aid on a severed limb. And he just mentions for his own software. He settled on graphic icons for categories of actions and drag and drop onto the hex map that launches a modal window where details of the action are inputted. Da, 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 blah, blah, blah. And actually, the way he does things is a little different. He's actually doing a kind of recorder to show the actions, not actually play the game. So it's a little different. The UI is a little different, but at least Rust gave me a clue into what he's talking about. I did look at some of other turn-based games, and I did do some internet searching to find out what people were doing when it comes to turn-based games these days. And basically, from my understanding, is they're custom-drawn UIs is what they are. They're completely custom, i.e. something like Unity based, where you have to draw your own windows. There's no you just don't bring up a window. You actually have to draw your own windows and things like that to show the information.
I think that requires a little bit of work on your part.
A lot of work on my part. I actually started working on an idea of what it could look like if I stripped it raw, you know, down to the building up from scratch again. I've got an idea. The toughest part at the moment, the first thing I ran into after, you know, I got some ideas for playing the game, but the online client isn't just about playing the game. It's also about the interaction of and chatting with the community. Now, actually, I want to get more. Who was it? I forget who it was. Let me see if we can find it real quick. If I can't, I'll quote them. That's kind of a neat idea. I'm not sure how useful that will be. There was one that was written, which was basically the idea of creating a game matching service. Which I understand the whole idea of a game matching service because of people aren't always online at all times. And since currently we have a very small subscriber base compared to StarCraft or Warcraft or some large multi-million dollar games, which I don't have millions of dollars. Sorry to tell you this, guys. I don't have the money.
You don't?
No, I don't. You know, I am not rich. But the one thing I was thinking of, and I can't seem to find it. I know it's here, which was one which is like not going to happen, which was basically it was Zoom for playing SFB Online. That's what it was. The idea is you had. Why do you want to do this? I don't quite know, but it's what the person suggested. Basically, you have a three-paned window. You have one window, which basically is just a video feed of your opponent. The other window is the board itself, and then another window, which is just for information about the different units and things like that. And depending upon which one you highlight, that one becomes like the main window and it gets larger. I don't see that. If you're trying to represent, you're trying to re-implement what, you know, the real life experience. If that's what you're trying, looking for doing a real life experience, that's the way to do it. And I agree. The one thing that I'm talking about it a little bit that intrigues me is this. Could that work? Could having not the SFB online, just because I'm talking about support, you know, when it comes to servers and all that kind of thing, that's not going to be a cheap thing to do to support video feeds. If I was to support it, you know, directly versus
you'd have to raise your fees a little bit.
Exactly. Oh, would I ever have to? But more to the point, as a service, would that actually be viable? The idea of actually having a gaming service where it has integrated into it the games themselves, but then also, and that's part of the whole package, you have video chat available to you. Now, this assumes, in my mind, that assumes that you're playing against friends. Because we all have the whole problem with, what was it called? Something roulette. Chat roulette or something like that. The whole problem is, of course, ne'er-do-wells exposing private parts on that chat roulette kind of thing. It's like, I don't think you want to be doing that.
No,
And
no.
then we have other issues, and so forth. But anyhow, moving onward. Some of these actually were kind of interesting. One of the ones was he's saying, I'd like to be able to play with a visible map where I can see everything. Now, see everything? Eh. I'm not exactly sure what you mean by it means by see everything. At the moment, you can do that. You can actually shrink the map, shrink the size of the hexes so you can see everything on the map. That's easy enough to do. You can do that now with the current client. And as I said, this is one of those things that, in my mind, that is a fault, my own fault. I haven't given people the tools to know how to change it, change the client, modify the client, have it so that they actually can actually do what they say. Oh, they want this, but that's already part of the client. So obviously they don't know about that. Then part of some of the suggestions that they have here are less related to the client itself and more related to how to do things. In this case, one of them was creating a user manual. folks, as a developer, who has limited amount of time, the question always is can I write, I can write the client or I can do the user manual. Which one do you want me to do? I can't do both at the same time. Now, I will have to fess up. For the past few years, I've been kind of skating by. I haven't really been improving the client all that much. A little thing here, a little thing there. So in theory, the client itself has been actually very stable. No big changes to the UI except for the past year where I really changed the Federation Commander UI to be a little bit easier to use. And so I could have written a user manual in that interim. The thing is, I wasn't hearing anything from people. Now that's probably
right.
Part of my own
there
issue.
There wasn't any demand for it.
What's that?
You weren't. There was no demand for it, so what's
right.
the point of doing it?
But again, that's partially it's my own fault because of I should have been more engaged with my community, and part of that is asking them. Maybe just send out a survey that hopefully will get some response on what do you want? How what do you think would help with improving the client or improving SAP Online in general, because that's what some of these things are in general. How you improve the service called SAP Online. So again, going back to the game matching thing, that's more of a modification to the service itself, not to the client. Because of, in my mind, see, it comes game matching for me means something different than game matching for StarCraft. StarCraft game matching is you get online, you say, I'm looking for an opponent, and then you find somebody who's already online, which has around the same skill level that you have. Now,
you can do that if you've got 10,000 clients.
That's what I was going to point out, which is basically that assumes that you have a large user base. But I think in my mind, this request that the person had is more along the lines, at least the way I read it. And it actually points it out here. It says people put in times they're available to play, and it lists call signs with a similar availability. The whole idea of you can basically say, hey, I want to play a game. When are you available? Or who's available when? Now, obviously, this requires some input by the community. The community itself has to say, these are, this is my calendar that I'm available to play in general.
Yeah.
Because short of actually having you let me tie into your calendar to see when you have a slot available, you know, like scheduling a meeting, you know, then it is what it is. Obviously, there actually are services out there that could possibly be used as a stopgap in the meantime.
Right.
Oh, this one. This one, okay, I'll get back to that one in a moment. Because that is a crazy one. Okay, that's there too. Well, actually, one of them was a chess clock, basically, like system. So the idea is that you know how much time each turn, each player takes for each thing that they do. So overall, at the end, you can say, oh, well, you spent 2 hours waiting for your opponent to reply versus your 1 hour of replying.
Speed SFD.
What's that? Speed SFD. Another one, which is this is a long standing. Oh my Lord, this was asked for 15 years ago. Tack and tell, implement tack and tell.
God.
Another one, which is possible, which is tracking plasma strength. In the moment, overall, it's already kind of, there's a partial thing there for it currently in that you can mark the damage done to individual plasmas or individual drones. You can currently track that. The client allows you to track the damage that is done firing upon those seeking weapons. Now, in this case, Lee Hanna.
They wanted to add was degradation due to distance.
Right. Basically, you know, what's the current strength of the plasma torpedo? And that's one of the things that would be doable, because we know what size the torpedo is, you know, what kind of torpedo is being launched. We know that.
Right. Another thing might be a time to live counter on a drone, which.
Well, actually, that probably would be right in there. Yeah. Now that would be easy enough to do, just because of that would be part of one of the modules that would be added to the drone, or the, you know, so we would know that.
Right.
This was one which actually I liked the idea. I just don't know how to implement it. Which was seeing the weapon status when you're allocating damage. So when you're prompted to which weapon you want to destroy, know what the weapon status is. Has it fired? Has it not fired? When's the last time it fired? Actually, I can see how I can do that for weapons. It'd be interesting because it'd be a different pop-up.
Or put a cooldown clock on weapons so you know when they've cycled to the point where they can fire again.
Yeah, I think it seems like it's less of an issue. That definitely was not mentioned. Now, Bob Brown says...
I just thought of it.
Yeah, understood. Bob Brown says, you know, floating map. Yeah, I understand that that's actually something that was proposed many, 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 many years ago. He said tutorial posts needed for introductory version. Also, this was... this also for learning the sight system. I'm not really sure what that means. But anyway, another one, which is, again, it's a failing on my part, which was, it'd be nice to be able to link modules to a starbase so that now one unit sharing power generation and damage allocation, same for pods and tugs. Currently, that is implemented. Well, the one thing's implemented, that you can attach a module to a starbase or a tug, and that will actually be part of your damage allocation. So when, so it will, by default, it, you can actually, and then you can set up the priority of what gets hit first. Do you hit the modules first, or do you hit the main systems first? And then when you actually hit a weapon system or a system that you have to ask about, it will prompt you. Okay, which one do you want to hit? Do you want to hit the module, or do you want to hit the base, or do, or, you know, module or the tug? You know, it allows you to attach. It's called attaching the module. Again, it's one of the things that obviously I've not explained enough so people know that this happens. Now, the one thing I cannot do at the moment is actually taking those two and doing an energy allocation for them. I still have, that's the one thing I have not done.
I am falling asleep here, so okay. I'm gonna.
I'll let you. Why don't you go? Because I'm gonna probably wrap this up in like 15 minutes. But I knew this was gonna run long.
Yeah. So, okay.
Well, you have
see
a good night.
Week. Night.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to go through these real quick because Lord knows it's getting late even for me. Now, okay. Let me, okay, obviously some of the more the things that have been asked for before, which is like an AI opponent. Auto-seeking weapon movement, which I actually, I forget if I actually have the implementation for that. I just haven't exposed it. Of course, as a player matching. So, okay. Well, actually, there was one thing which Russ pointed out. I'll hit that real quick, which was there. I had, as I mentioned last week, I had this one drop down. It was called authenticated mode. Authenticated mode. The whole idea is that it's not offline mode, because you can't do offline mode anymore. You still have to be connected to the internet to use the client. You have to log in, and the login, if you want to add any ship to a room or whatever, you can do that, because it has to download it from the servers and so forth. So it has to be connected to the internet to do this mode. But it's like I couldn't think of a better way of handling it. But then Russ said, how about calling a single player mode? And it's like, ding, ding, ding. We've got a winner. So with the next release of the client, I will be changing the name of that from authenticated mode to single player mode. Because basically, you're kind of offline in that you don't actually log in. And you don't. People don't see you playing around with the room. In fact, they don't see it at all. It's all local. The only reason you have to log in at all is because if you want access to the ships, and, you know, basically access to the ships. That's why I had to create an authenticated mode. Previously, when I actually had the ability to download the ships, you download those ships, you know, then you could play offline. Well, offline no longer exists, so now it's single player mode. Which, thank you, Russ, for such an awesome suggestion, which I snagged immediately. And actually, some of the things he suggested, I was thinking about a new way of visiting the client, and actually he hit on it, some of the things, which was basically the whole idea of the actions are buttons. That idea, but his is a little different in that you drag the action onto the map. When you're actually playing it, you wouldn't actually drag the action onto the map. You just want to click the action. Because one of my envisions for I'll get back to that in a moment, because I don't want to go without what I have. Some of the things I have an idea for implementing some of these things, or some of the suggestions that were made. Some of the things I can do without actually redoing the client. Other ones will require a total redo of the client. One person said, "I'll drop Java." Well, you do not know what you speaketh of, my dear friend. If you drop Java, I have to re-implement the whole thing from scratch. Now, I wanted to do that anyway. But that also means that I have to build up those features a little bit at a time. But anyhow, the one thing I want to mention before I get to that, you know, that whole idea, which is, I wish I had time to do a quick drawing up of the client. Well, I envisioned it, you know, so that I actually could show you on the video, but I can't. Because it was basically skeleton drawing on a piece of paper. But anyway, I'm sorry. I know you're all waiting for what I wanted to say before that and talk about that. And that is that one person, and I'm not sure people would be too thrilled with this idea, which is basically making SFB more of a video game in this category. And that is, it's a timed system. Each time that, basically, the impulses would automatically go boom every 10 seconds, boom, another 10 seconds, boom, another 10 seconds, boom. And you've got that short period of time to respond. If you want your ship to move, you know, you want to turn, you got 10 seconds, boom, another 10 seconds, boom. For each time you move, it's gonna be timed. If you want to, you can have it down to like 5 seconds. And they said, oh yeah, at the same time, I'd like to have it so that you can pause it. What's the point? At that point, what's the point of pausing? If the whole idea, at least I feel like when they said that, they're saying, okay, I want it more like a video game, so we have more motion, more moving. And that's what would happen, is that basically it kind of enforces a speed SFB. And I like the idea. I think it's kind of a neat, it's a new inventive idea. But then you say, oh, well, it should allow people to pause. It's like, yeah, but other than having an actual action to do, you shouldn't have to pause. And that also comes down to, then you have to, we're talking about many months ago, where the whole idea of speed SFB, where you have a limited amount of time to, you bring up an action, you have a limited amount of time to respond to that action. Okay, I'm going to launch my drones. Okay, you've got 1 minute. And you have the timer going, 59, 58, 57. So you have to do all your selection within a minute. You know, and if you don't, sorry, we're moving on. I'm not quite sure people would be interested in doing that. But I do like some of that. The idea of moving it forward, and also that the chess clock, which actually has been brought up before, the whole idea of having a chess clock, I got to think about the chess clock a little more, because I like the idea. Always the tough part always is going to be. Normally with a chess clock, you have one opponent, and most part with SFB, you have one opponent. How do you know when your opponent's turn for doing something and your turn to do something? You know, for chess, it's simple. Your move, his move, your move, his move, your move, his move. This has to be a little more complicated. Obviously, that's one of those things that I would love to have a nice discussion about. How would you implement a chess clock when it comes to SFB? How? Comes movement? Movement is relatively easy. You know, okay. No, if you know who goes first, you have to wait for that person, and then they wait for you. Now, here's always the gotcha. And I'm sure everyone's done this. Sooner or later, someone's always done this, which is moved when they're not supposed to move. What happens then? In other words, you move first. Yeah, which you're not supposed to move first. Your opponent's supposed to move first. Now, either you don't care or you slip up. Most of the time, you know, you don't care because you might notice it almost immediately and then go, oh, I'm going to back up and I'll rethink what I did. But then there's also the time where they slip up, the person moves, and then they go, yeah, I'm fine. Or, no, I want to redo my move because I'm supposed to move after you. How do you do it then? Do you then force the people to actually move in the proper sequence of play? Might be the only way to do it. Now, before we leave for this evening, because this evening is going to be wrapped up real quick because it's getting kind of late, I just want to show a real quick idea I have. Now, I'm just going to show it on the video. This is the whole idea of it. And that is, you have this whole big map, a single page map. Okay, let's move up a little further. So people can actually see it. What I think this might be, a little bit over to. I think I got that right. And the idea is that you got the whole large map, and then you have the individual counters, and then you have this. In this, at the moment, I'm thinking of just like a drop-down list for those ships that are selected. They're selected, or if you don't have any selected, maybe if you highlight over a single icon, maybe a stack of counters, it will then show you the information about that. There actually was one suggestion that, when you click on a hex where there's multiple ships, it then expands into a large representation of the hex with ships in the different facings, which I'm not exactly sure that's the best idea to do. It looks nice, but the thing is, positionally, it makes no sense. Positionally, you're not going to show the relativity to each other because you can't, because there's no relative position in a hex. But then over here was basically an idea of buttons for actions. Now, with the whole idea of the one thing I was trying, I've got this in my mind. And the thing is, I'm still working out if this is possible to do at all. I think it is. But it requires a rethink of how people play the game. And that is that it goes back to way back when with the whole argument, which was like 13 years ago, which was pure impulse activity versus call for fire. And the whole idea was that... What I'm trying to do is avoid the whole metagame aspect of it, in my mind anyway. At least that was to me, that was the ultimate solution, is to remove metagaming altogether, because this is where the argument came up. Because the argument came up because of Call for Fire allows people to see that, yes, I'm not going to do any activity, and I'm going to call for fire. So they have that problem. Of course, the current mechanism still has the problem with metagaming issue, that you say, you click the button, say, I got activity, and then you select your activity and your opponent selects their activities, if they have anything, and they say, no, they don't have any activity. Now, obviously you can meta the meta, which is say, just kind of try to fake out your opponent. But the whole idea of the metagaming to begin with is that you have to actually think that through so deeply, is because of You do an action that means you want to do an action. That means, in the case of your opponent might just say, you know, since you're doing an action, I'm gonna do an action too. In this case, when it comes to this is why I have a whole issue with call for fire, which is you're calling for fire, and in theory, again, you can do a fake and say, call for fire, and oh, I don't have any fire. You can do that in theory, but the thing is, most people do that? Probably not. Every once in a while, I've seen that happen in a game against an opponent of mine, where he'll say, oh, he's going to call for fire, and then he does nothing. Every once in a while. But, you know, the whole idea is to fake out somebody and so forth. But, see, the ultimate solution that I had for this was actually that each and every single turn, the players, which they're running, they're doing the controlling, they had to click next impulse, next impulse, next impulse. If they had nothing to do, no action to take, they click next impulse, next impulse, next impulse, next impulse. While if you had an action, you have your action. Now, in theory, the thing is, if you click next impulse and then your opponent says, they click, oh, I want to fire, and they select what they're going to want to fire, then in that case, you know, your opponent has nothing they can do because they've already selected they're going next impulse. They already said, I'm not going to do any activity. So they're already stuck. They can't say, oh, you know, since it seems like you're taking a few minutes to reply, that means you're probably doing an action. At that point, it's too late. You might know there's an action going to be taking place. Too late. But anyway, the whole idea is to abstract out the actions. Currently, you click on activity and it brings up the activity dialog, the activity window. Select your impulse activity, when the impulse activity is, and move forward. So, in that case, since you're going to, you have to know when you're going to do it and so forth. But the key is what I was thinking about doing is as part of the changes to the client, is to abstract that all out. Have it so you click on what you're going to do when they come for you. But, you know, so that you say, okay, no action. Or have it timed out. You have a timer. Like you have so many seconds to decide if you're going to do an action or not. Either that, or as you know, my original implementation, the ultimate, which is next impulse, next impulse, next impulse. So, given that, I think that would be, it would obfuscate the whole thing. It'd make it a lot more easier for people to understand what's going on, what to do. Obviously, that's still, as I originally wrote up the thing here, originally that had the most actions that you do the most of. For example, fire, launching plasma launching drones, launching shuttles / fighters, thing, you know, those would be buttons, but there would be one down near the bottom called miscellaneous. So in other words, something that's not covered, like, you know, I can have tractors there, but certain, like, oh, a hit and run raid, you know, or certain things like that, where it'd be crazy to have this long list of actions. Because in theory, you could have somewhere around 20 different actions that you could have listed. You know, and most of them people wouldn't use. And depending upon, like, for example, a good example of this. Satorian Web Breakers / Shield Crackers. Those suckers, they don't fire. They do not fire. The Shield Crackers do not fire on during the fire decision phase. No, it don't. It actually fires during the shield raising up and down phase. So that's a totally different weapon. Goes for a totally different impulse activity. Displacement. That's a separate segment, which is run right before fire decision, is just to announce that you have a displacement activity. Having a button for displacement is kind of crazy, because how many people actually have a displacement device that they're actually going to click that button? Yes, you could actually modify the actions available based on the ships that you have on the board. I mean, that you personally own. But still, it's kind of crazy. The question is, how many buttons should be there? But as I pointed out, the whole idea of it is more of a hiding the impulse segments. Hiding it so that it's taken care of. And let's say that you want to launch a drone after someone has already announced fire. You can't do that because of it's after fire. So those buttons would be grayed out and so forth. So, and it'd be great and all, but I think that I have to wait and see. I'll create a beta or something and have people look at it and give me some feedback on it. But anyway, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.